All right, this week.
That was very breathy. I'm going to do it less breathy.
This week on the Eldritch Lorecast.
What do you call each individual Lego?
A Lego.
A piece of Lego.
With our friends from Chaosium running a $10,000 competition.
One of the contributing factors to me becoming a professional game designer was a game design contest.
Adventurously migrating into one place, which is D&D Beyond.
Trash isn't the best way to describe that, especially since I did a lot of work on it. But maybe that's why it was trash.
Well, ask Sly Flourish. I'm sure he has opinions on your contributions to Adventurously.
All that and more right now. 3, 2, 1. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of the Eldritch Lorecast, the number one cultural studies tabletop RPG podcast in all the realms. That's right. You come here for your Australia versus America facts, which we will hopefully have plenty of later in this video. My name's Ben Byrne, or this podcast, if you're listening to us on audio. My name's Ben Byrne. I'm joined, as always, by Dale Kingsmill, James Hake, Sean Merwin, and Sean... speaking of Australia versus America cultural studies, I'm going to jump a question from later in the episode to the top. This coming in from Seamus asking, why do Americans pronounce Lego with an S? They say Legos.
Mm. Well, it's pretty simple, really. What do you call each individual Lego?
A Lego.
A piece of Lego.
We call them a brick. Always.
Oh, yeah,
call them
yeah, yeah.
So a Lego brick. You put together the Lego bricks, or you buy... two or three sets of Lego. So everything that you do with that, sets, bricks, structures, minifigs, is all pluralized with an S. So if you're talking about the general concept of the Lego company and what they build, I find it much easier to say Legos. Yeah, we played with Legos today because we didn't just play with a single Lego. We played with multiple bricks and put together multiple buildings and multiple sets.
But you call a school of fish fish. That's plural fish. And if there were multiple schools of fish, you would call them schools of fish.
No, we call them fishes.
We call them fishes.
No!
We call
them fish eyes. No! I'm sorry, Dante. I gotta rip.
The plural, as far as I know, the beer is beer. Mm-hmm. But you would say I drank 12 beers, not 12 beers.
No. Yeah, right. I would never say, like, could I have 3 beers?
I mean, to be totally serious, grammatically, I would probably, if I was writing Lego in a doctoral dissertation, do it correctly because that's correct. Mm-hmm. But if I'm talking, it's informal, I'm going to say what sounds to me and my peers most right. And
I will not be made to bow down to the Swedes brand guidelines.
Yeah.
I will not say Lego bricks.
Okay. All right. Well, here's my follow-up question. I'm going to ask this of you, James Hake, so that people listening to the audio version can familiarize themselves with your voice. What is the plural of Pokemon?
Okay. Well, let's do some dramaturgy on this one, because if you ask me today, I would say Pokemon. Right. It's a Japanese word. Yeah. Japanese words they don't distinguish between plurals. They're Pokemon. I think even as a kid, I called them Pokemon. But I would say that all the adults around me called them Pokemans.
Mans.
Yeah. It was Pokemon.
Kind of like a, you know, the plural affects the final vowel mm-hmm, in that mm-hmm. sentence.
Not to throw in a little bit of extra evidence, but also in the fandom, people will often refer to plural Pokemon as Mons. Mm-hmm. These are my Mons.
I would say one Pikachu, two Pikachus, though. I would pluralize the individual Mons.
One Pikachu.
Okay.
Two Pikachu.
Two Pikachu. Three Pikachu. Four. What about Raichu? Would you consider two Raichu or
there's
two Raichus?
There's a herd of Raichu over there. I would say Raichu is both singular and
just
plural.
Just testing it out.
Yeah.
Dale Kingsmill, to ask you a cultural question, castle or castle?
Castle, always and forever. Castle, dance, another example that hasn't immediately leapt to mind.
Wait. You said castle. And then you said dance.
Yes. And I think it's important to recognize that it's not about saying the same sound the same way in every single word across the board. It's about what's right, Benjamin. And what's right is going to a dance at the local castle.
I have a follow-up about this, because this is actually relevant to our actual theme, which is D&D.
For new listeners, by the way, this is a tabletop RPG podcast. You wouldn't have guessed.
Because I have been chastised by editors before for doing this colloquial thing of just kind of using singular or plural, you know, pluralizing with an S or pluralizing identical to the singular just based on vibes alone. Before, when it comes to monsters, right? What's the plural of troll? It's trolls. What's the plural of abishai? I think it's abishai. However, editors, D&D editors, will tell you when you're making up these fantasy words, if at all possible, you should always pluralize them in a standard way. You should always pluralize them distinctly from the singular, because it's not a real word. People have no cultural context to back them up on this. So even though it hurts me to say abishais when talking about dragon demons, that is more correct editorially.
Yeah, I would agree with you 100% on everything you just said. Creatively, it hurts me somewhat, especially because theoretically within the cultural context of the worlds that these D&D adventures are taking place in, they may have their own ways of saying these things. But D&D as a game folds in so many cultures and mythologies from across the world that would have so many different ways of approaching these individual words that, you know, and words that didn't exist in their original mythologies from which they, you know, from which certain concepts originate from, that seems like the safest route to take.
Style guides are your friend, folks.
Bit of news starting this week with our friends from Chaosium. They are offering... All right, now I'm going to be honest here. I dislike the way that this has been worded, but I'm going to word it the same way, and I'll explain why. They are offering a 10,000... or they are running a $10,000 competition for you, dear listener, if you are so inclined, to design a game or a world setting or a adventure, whatever you want to create, using their basic role-playing universal game engine, which they released last year and which is used by famously Call of Cthulhu. And when I say I dislike the way that this is worded, it's because the competition isn't for $10,000. The winners, or there will be 10 entrants shortlisted, they will receive $500 each. And then of those 10, three winners will be chosen to receive $2,000 prize. And then there will be a public voted winner who will also receive $500. So a $10,000 prize pool in total. But I still think it's misleading because it makes it sound like you'll get granted $10,000. This is being run as a competition. I don't know if I've made this clear whatsoever or I've just kind of word vomited this news out, but to sum it up, Chaosium running a competition. If you want to design a setting, adventure, you know, game based on their basic role-playing universal game engine, they are running a competition that will reward you money if you can design said product.
Cool. I have strong opinions about game design contests. I probably, one of the contributing factors to me becoming a professional game designer was a game design contest. Kobold Press ran some game design contests, one of which I won, which led me to getting future work with them. Up until that point, I had kind of constantly been warned against competitions like this, competitions where you basically do creative work on spec, essentially, for a company, and they own what you make, regardless of whether you win or lose, because for copyright reasons. And you might get a chance to maybe get published and maybe get some money. Professionals will often tell you, don't do that. Don't work for spec. Don't work for exposure. It's terrible. They're exploiting you. And my feelings on that are complicated because I've profited both, you know, materially and immaterially from, you know, being on the good end of that stick.
Can I potentially allay some of your fears?
Yeah, go for it.
For this specific competition, because it is interesting to me that they're running it as a competition when it sounds more like you're kind of almost applying for a miniature grant.
Mm-hmm.
Or grant.
Grant, definitely grant.
Basically, to enter the competition, you need more than just a manuscript of your adventure or your product. You need to also outline how it uses their system effectively, why it is unique and your audience that you will kind of pitch it to, and you need to let them know how you're going to use the money that you gain to publish your product yourself. So they're not going to publish it.
It really is like a Furthermore, grant application. Okay.
It really is, yeah. Furthermore, they've said that it'll be published under, if you choose to publish, it'll be published under the Orc license because the Universal Game Role-Playing System, whatever it's called, is published under the Orc license. And any specific IP that you come up with as part of this competition, let's say you create a world setting, is not owned by Chaosium. Whether you win or whether you're shortlisted, you win or you don't win the competition. So your IP theoretically remains your own. I'm not sure how that interacts with the Orc because I it's been a while since I've looked at the Orc, but I think it has a little bit of language in there about like anybody who publishes under the Orc, their content is open to be used by anybody else publishing under the Orc. I don't know if that's specifically IP content or that's just rules content that you create. I was talking about this with someone earlier. It's like if Ghostfire, you know, published some transformations under the Orc, would that mean that folk can use transformation mechanics in their own that we come up with, but they can't use specific Grim Hollow terms, words, IP. I'm not sure. It's been a while since I've read it, but we were kind of speculating around that earlier. But Chaosium, at least in the wording of this competition, have said that they're not going to claim ownership over your IP or any of the work that you do. They're just basically wanting to get more people into publishing work with the basic role-playing Universal Gaming.
Yeah, I think that's very noble. Noble goal.
In the before times when there were journals, literary magazines, a scam, I call it a scam, would be submit your poem, submit your story to us, send us $10 and your story, and we will consider it for our contest issue. We will pick 5 winners and publish those. And that, that was on the edge of a scam, because little did you know they were getting 500,000 submissions anyway before the contest. So they were making this money and then paying you $10 to submit to publish your story. So that's where this line that James is talking about, that's why writers will say watch out for things like that. This definitely doesn't fit into that. I wouldn't call it noble because this is great advertising. Right. Yeah. This is money well spent that you could spend on Facebook ads that might or might not get you anything. Whereas this gets people using your rules. It gets people looking at your books, may cause people to buy your books that wouldn't have otherwise. So it's a good PR move, as well as good for people that want to make content in this setting.
Yeah. Someone in chat does ask, what does Contract Ale think about the ORC thing? From memory, the language that was built into the ORC will have been to ensure that no one using the ORC license can then put a license on those rules from there. It has to trickle down through there. So that will be language built in related to the mechanics. But I also haven't read it in a long time, so I can't say that for certain. And my thoughts on the actual competition, I am a fan of anything that gets people creating fresh stuff. I think it's exciting to sort of have this prospect of new settings and concepts and genres that are applying these game rules. Because, I mean, Ben and I have argued about this before. I quite like the idea of the core sort of game loop of this system. Yeah, I don't know what the core game is called either. Universal, blah, blah, blah.
It's literally it's a mouthful.
The one
it's like they wanted to SEO every role-playing term into the title.
Deep percentile, you want to roll low, blah blah blah. Particularly because Call of Cthulhu is not actually like the mechanics are not directly tied in my opinion, to the genre and the stories that you tell in Call of Cthulhu. And that is just the game that they are most known for being used in. And I'm kind of excited to see how that core can be applied to other genres, other games, other concepts. Particularly, I mean, a while back, years and years ago, I accidentally created kind of a game design festival that we called GameOrimo because we were doing it in November and I just was leaping on a hashtag for NaNoWriMo. And we ended up with just heaps of people going, oh yeah, this is fun. Let me take a month and just see what I can create, what adventure, what class, what, you know, indie one page sure. RPG I can come up with in that month. And it was awesome to see how much creativity blossoms out of an event like that. And I'm, you know, really excited to see the kind of stuff that people are going to create in relation to this.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's cool. I also agree with Sean. I think that it's, you know, please use our system. You don't need to use 5e. You can use, you know, under the OGL or under, you know, Creative Commons or whatever. Here's another great system to make, just please make games for us. Is how I read it a little bit.
But I want to talk about this, like the concept of the open call contest, just a little more from the perspective sure. of someone who's trying to break into the industry, because again, that was in part, at least my experience. It often feels like, especially right now in the mid 2020s, that it is impossible to break in anywhere, right? Around the time the fifth edition launched, there were actually a handful of real, you know, unvarnished open calls, right? Adventurers League was like, send in a, you know, a 2-page test adventure that uses this prompt with a manticore. And I put my prompt in and I got it returned with notes being like, this is bad. And I was like, oh, okay. and, you know, when I was running Insider, the 5e magazine for AN World, we did open calls all the time because we just needed writers to give words on the page. But it feels like now with fifth edition fairly long in the tooth, or at least, you know, well established, and people who have fled 5e have found homes in other RPG companies, everything feels very well established right now. And so to get into the establishment feels impossible. So for someone who sees this, this is an extremely clearly signposted opportunity. We want new things and new people. Apply here. It almost doesn't even need to be a contest, right? If forget the fact that it's a contest. No. This is people who want to see new stuff. Because every time I see an open call on the internet these days, I expect, well, you know, they'll look for the 100 names they recognize and have been hoping to get for a while anyway. And if you're not one of those names, they'll barely look at your draft. I don't know if that's true, but it's the way it feels. And it's the way I can imagine someone who is totally new feeling. So this, honestly, if you're just looking to give writing out there, forget that it's a contest. This is an open call that wants to hear from you.
Yeah, and you should be doing this anyway as a game designer.
Yeah. Right?
You should be taking on these challenges and trying to do different things and take a one-page RPG and make another version of it and stretch these muscles and do these things. Absolutely.
The fact that you need to have a plan about how you're going to potentially take this to publication and how you're going to use their money feels, I think, as someone on the outside, because I've done this sort of stuff before in, you know, performing arts realms, and I've applied for, you know, writing sort of competition or call out style things as well. And when they put these extra things in place, about like needing a financial plan, it can feel very much like it can feel like barriers, you know, in front of an extra thing you have to do that's kind of a pain, because I'm not financially minded at all. I don't know how to write a financial plan. I don't know what I want to do. You know, it would just be handy to be able to, you know, I realize I need that money as seed funding to, there's a term for you, to, you know, start a process of publication, but I don't know how to create that plan. That all being said, I think that it's actually really great that they have these in place, because it means that they're going to get serious applicants who are serious about publishing their content, and really have the drive and the passion for it. And additionally, I didn't read the specific terms of the competition, so I could be wrong about this. It's all on Chaosium's website, chaosium.com, if you want to go take a look. But you don't have to enter necessarily as an individual, right? If you have a you know, two of you that are passionate, one of you is really good at game design, one of you is better at business, and you want to put your heads together to create an entrant entrants for this competition. In theory, you could do that, right? So don't feel like you have to battle it alone if you have mm-hmm. friends or colleagues or connections that can help you, realize this together. Speaking of realizing things together, many adventures are realized together when folk play in Adventurers League, the Dungeons & Dragons organized play, which is migrating together into one place, which is D&D Beyond, and nobody was surprised. All Adventurers League news, updates, articles will now all be based on D&D Beyond instead of blasted to the ether of the internet. I learned yesterday when researching this that the Yawning Portal was a website. I actually didn't know that before yesterday, but that is no longer going to be the case to get your Adventurers League news. There's already a new blog that hit D&D Beyond within the last week, I think, introducing new players to the concept of Adventurers League. That blog's quite long and also includes resources such as the player and DM guide for Adventurers League, the specific things that players and DMs need to do to participate. And as I just mentioned, we'll end the use of websites like the Yawning Portal and kind of unify AL content all in one place.
It's been quite a ride. The most important thing that you can do for an organized play program is communicate clearly, answer people's questions who may want to come and use your Adventurers League products and games and find new places to play. And if they, one, cannot find it, or two, are told 12 different places to have to find different pieces of information, well, go here for Discord for this and this website for this. It kills the marketing effort before it even starts. This is good. People are already using D&D Beyond. So good place to send everyone. The question is always this. I'm an Adventurers League organizer or administrator, and we have a big announcement. We need to get this information out quickly. Oh, we have to go to D&D Beyond. We can't just type things into D&D Beyond. It's not Twitter. It's not Discord. So now we have to go through this process of getting this information to D&D Beyond. When will it go up? Can it go up today? What, next week? Wait, a month? Wait, it has to be approved by who? Wait, what? That's the situation that the Adventurers League has been in forever. And so this is good that it's going there. The question is, how reactive can they be in getting more information up?
I'm a little confused about where, with Adventurers League specifically, about where the community stops and Wizards of the Coast kind of starts, right? Because this is their official organized play thing that is largely run by the community, which is great. But, like you were just saying, at what point does someone from the community have license and ability to post to D&D Beyond or create something on D&D Beyond for Adventurers League?
You are asking the $100 million question, if $100 million is how much Wizards puts into marketing. Their relationship with the Adventurers League and with other forms of organized play over the years has been as wildly divergent as you can imagine. At some points, they're pouring resources into their organized play because they realize it's a great marketing tool and it motivates their most rabid, avid fans to not just play, but to evangelize for them. When the Adventurers League or the Role Playing Game Association before it was at its best, people would go to Gen Con, play games, and they would go back to their home groups or their stores or their local conventions and tell everyone how great it was. And the next time they went to Gen Con, they were bringing four or five people with them, either to play or to Game Master, which then expands and expands and expands. And so when you see that, you realize what a great tool it could be. And then you pour money into it. But then you make some poor decisions, or offerings start to buckle under their own weight and things start going downhill. And then the people who come in charge at Wizards look at it and say, why are we pouring money into this? It's, people don't like it. Everyone's complaining about it on the internet. They don't like the new rules changes. Why are we doing this? So let's cut funding. And then they cut funding, and everyone who was super invested says, why'd you cut funding? This was my game. I was doing all this work for you because you were giving us great content and fun and community. Now what do I do? And then it's a cycle that repeats itself over and over and over again. And it's all down this chain. People don't quite know what to do with this concept of organized play, how to best use it, how to best fund it. And it's a cyclical, it's a trash compactor that just crunches, spits out, and then we're ready to refill it again. Trash isn't the best way to describe that, especially since I did a lot of work on it. But maybe that's why it was trash. I don't know. Somebody stop me.
Well, ask Sly Flourish. I'm sure he has opinions on your contributions to Adventurers League. I want to fold in the next topic, the next piece of news, which is related to this, which is that Greasy Snitches has become a premier Adventurers League organizer. Greasy Snitches are a D&D organizer group from the Philippines who have worked since 2016 to organize D&D and Adventurers League community events. And they have been, and I'm not sure who, again, whether this came from Wizards or whether this came from Adventurers League organizers, but at some point, Greasy Snitches have been ordained as a premier organizer, which means that they'll work closely with Greg Marks, the top of Adventurers League, the head of Adventurers League, the key organizer of Adventurers League, to create premier epic adventures at Greasy Snitches events when they run them. They'll be given an exclusive area within the Forgotten Realms to set their adventures and are given product support. Again, I'm just kind of like taking terms from the blog article I read on the Yawning Portal. I'm not sure if product support means like special dice or, you know, printed adventures or what that means. They can also provide, and this is, I need help with this term as well, certificate items at their events. Is that like I get a certificate that says I have this magic item and I can cash it in with every GM that I play with, like after that point, is what I've assumed.
Basically.
And
I did legit Snitches, get this Holy Avenger, says right here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My GMC signed GM from, you know, location. And also they're the first, as far as I'm aware, the first international Adventurers League premier organizer outside of the US. So congratulations to them. Further to my questions before, and again, I'm not sure if there's a question here. So are they ordained by Wizards or is this like an Adventurers League specific?
It's actually the Pope.
Oh, really? Okay.
The answer is likely both. The Adventurers League administrators, I think there are three right now, who Greg Marks being one of them. Greg is in charge of working with these premier organizers. So he probably, along with Chris Tulak, who is a Wizards of the Coast employee, who at this point is an overseer of the Adventurers League on the Wizards staff. Chris is also in charge of event organization, or at least he has been in the past, and I think he still is. So he would be in charge of going, taking Wizards to Gen Con and having some special events going on there. So the answer is all of the above. What this says to me is that the Greasy Snitches, who I know have done great work for evangelizing D&D and the Adventurers League in the Philippines, running huge events. What this says is that Wizards loves the work that they've done, and so they are going to give them the ability to do even more fun, cool things to bring even more players to their events. That's why Bald Man Games and Gamehole Publishing from Gamehole Con also have this designation where they can make specific adventures in specific regions. Bald Man Games is in Forgotten Realms, is the Moonshae Isles, and it's the Bandit Kingdoms, I think, for Gamehole Publishing. Mm-hmm. They can make adventures there, put them on the DM's Guild, run special events at their events. And because they've proven that they know how to do it and have helped the community grow in those areas.
See, that is so cool. That was the thing that I was reading that I was like, I don't know what that means exactly, but it sounds really dope to get your own little corner of the Forgotten Realms that's like yours. This is your kingdom, your designation. I love that. That sounds sick.
You know what they need is an Australian group that could go to events and create things. If you know anyone in Australia who knows damn all about game design.
I mean, we had a... Well, this is why I've been a little bit confused by this, is because Australia, at least in Melbourne, speaking for Melbourne, had a fairly strong Adventurers League. I think we still do. They've kind of... I haven't had my ear to the ground with Adventurers League because it's, you know, I don't want to like bring up this whole topic and then poo-poo it. It's just not my thing personally, because I'm not a fan of the Forgotten Realms. Not that I dislike the Forgotten Realms. I'm just not a fan of the Forgotten
Cover
Realms.
Cover your back, Ben.
We just keep digging
dig
this,
that hole.
Digging this hole. Yeah, exactly. But I do know a couple of, you know, folks who ran Adventurers League or folks who have done adventures, like written adventures, that went on to DM's Guild and became official Adventurers League adventures that could be run at Adventurers League events in Australia, and in fact was given some of these to run when I did do Adventurers League events here. And I was kind of like, can anybody just, like within specific rules, can anybody just create an adventure under the OGL, publish it to DM's Guild, and as long as it meets specific guidelines, it can be used by any Adventurers League event?
The answer is yes, sometimes.
Okay.
There are certain campaigns within the Adventurers League that will allow you to create adventures that are official, and you can put them on the DM's Guild, and any Adventurers League game master, as long as they're within that campaign, can grab it, use it, and it's yours. Now, can you do that for any campaign? No. There are might be a campaign like what we did for Eberron, the Oracle of War campaign. I worked on that with Will Doyle. And so there were just this series of official adventures. That's all you could run. But then we saw that people loved this campaign, but they wanted more. They wanted to not just run a four-hour event level and then run the next four-hour event. They wanted to do their own things. So we created a way for people to create their own adventures that were restricted in the treasure you could give out, that were restricted in certain ways, but you could, and then you could put those up on the DM's Guild and run with those.
They're a great resource. I think if I'm remembering correctly, Tomb of Annihilation had an Adventurers League season. Mm-hmm. Am I correct in saying? Mm-hmm. And I think there were quite a few written adventures put up on Adventurers League by just, you know, hobby writers and writers within the community. Community writers is probably the term I'm looking for. Mm-hmm. And they were great because one of the real criticisms of Tomb of Annihilation was it's this big hex crawl, but it feels relatively empty, and even some of the marked places on the map only get a paragraph within the book to outline what's there when it feels like it could be a full dungeon. And these little Adventurers League adventures kind of helped flesh out. I think there's a bunch for Curse of Strahd and Ravenloft as well that people have done, whether associated with Adventurers League or not, but they're just great for kind of fleshing out the corners of the adventure that a GM might struggle with inventing themselves if they're not that sort of GM who really enjoys that work.
This, I think, is where public perception of Adventurers League sometimes has a bit of a crisis, because around, now, Sean, you might have to correct me on this, but around the time of Tomb of Annihilation, Adventurers League content that followed the official adventures started basically telling a sub-story within the same location, right? You're not following the plot of Tomb of Annihilation. There's something else happening in Chult related to the Death Curse, related to all that. And there is a narrative through line that follows tier one, tier two, tier three, tier four. And it became a bit difficult, I think, to be able to use those adventures paired with the main hardcover in a cohesive way. And I saw this pretty clearly in the Waterdeep one. And maybe I'm just sensitive because I care a lot about that Waterdeep adventure for some reason. But you know, the Adventurers League stuff in there, it doesn't serve that same, you know, here's some extra encounters functionality as well as, say, the ones in Curse of Strahd or Tomb of Annihilation or Storm King's Thunder, all of which are places with huge maps that need lots of filling in.
And what you're talking about now is this balance that organized play has trouble holding on to, which is you have a certain group of players who will play the hardcover when it comes out, right? They played Tyranny of Dragons. They got through it in 2 months, and they want something else official. Oh, here's Adventurers League games you can play. But they want more, and then they want more. And so you feed them 200 adventures that they can play, and they're happy. But it takes away the special feeling, the community of the people that only play once a month, and they want to have that feeling of, we're playing these 12 special adventures, and we're a community all coming together, and we're all playing the same thing. And so now if you have 200 versus 12, your people are, I don't even want to start. There's 200 adventures to choose from. I don't know where to start. I don't know what to do. I'm not going to even get into Adventurers League. So you're trying to balance that need, that want of very different demographic and play style and play frequency groups. And some people will go to their grave saying, you know, this organized play, there should just be a set number of adventures and that's it. And it will make it special and people will play it and love it and be part of the community. Then there will be the people that say, let us have 400 adventures, which is probably 1/10 of what's up on the DMs Guild right now in terms of a playable content for Adventurers League. It's just so much.
Which actually speaks to a strength of the Adventurers League in some way, which is that it's curated, right? There is so much content out there, as much as I hate to use the word content, but there's so much playable game out there that it can be hard to distinguish what is truly good from what is truly bad, especially because TTRPGs have this sort of unique problem where good and bad kind of comes down to the people you're playing with also. You know, I've run plenty of bad adventures and had a great time with them. But if you want, and to be fair, some of those came from curated sources also, so it's not an exact science either. But, you know, at least there's a sort of seal of approval, right? You can come to doubt the usefulness of that seal of approval, but if someone says, this is the good stuff, boom, then, you know, you're way more likely to go to that than to go digging yourself and making your own value judgments about what's good.
And you know who it is handing out that seal? Pope.
Always.
I'm creating this sort of alternate universe here. can I excommunicate someone from Adventurers League?
And the plural of Pope is Pope.
That's good radio.
Mm-hmm. Has there ever been a plural? Has there ever been a need for the plural of Pope?
Literally, I guess there's a year called the Year of Three Popes.
No. The Year of Three Pope.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of the Pope, and ordained things, Cobalt Press have ordained Steamforged to create a Tales of the Valiant physical starter set. Seamless. That will introduce players to Tales of the Valiant, the starter set designed to scaffold players, introducing the Tales of the Valiant rules kind of incrementally a little bit at a time. There's very few details about what this product will actually look like because it's just a partnership announcement at the moment. But it was cool. I like Steamforged games. They create cool products. And it just made me wonder, I'm like, is this going to be like a really miniature heavy starter set, which I would think would be cool. That would be something that, like, if I had all the minis in a box. It would
certainly set them apart from most other starter sets.
Right? I don't know if that's what they're going to do, but that would be cool.
I think there's a great market out there for the prestige $60 board game box style starter set. D&D has cornered the market on the $20 buy it at Target box set, which Pathfinder has attempted to copy many times over to moderate success, I would say. But I've never seen someone try and do a box of like The Descent, but actually it's also a whole RPG if you want to go spin off into Wildland beyond it. I can see that as an untapped market for real. And honestly, and just as a player, I would love to have it. I love robust starter sets.
For sure. I mean, I've brought up multiple times and every single time someone tells me what the name of the product I'm talking about is. And every single time I forget what the name of the product is. But Pathfinder 1 used to have a board game out there. I think it was sort of a deck builder style board game. Mm-hmm. But the point of it was to introduce you to the concepts and rules that are involved in the Pathfinder tabletop RPG so that you could at some point transition from, oh, now I love my character from this board game and I want to keep playing them. Well, do I have good news for you here, Curse of the Crimson Throne, you know, that sort of a thing. And that was a very successful, as far as my understanding reaches, that was a very successful product. I still want to go out and find it and play it myself, even though I know how to play. So I think that that would be a really cool avenue to take. Even if I still don't like the name Tales of the Valiant.
Yeah, I mean, I have a little box. It's like a toolbox of miniatures that always have the same minis in them that I take to every session. And these are generic minis like this slot has soldiers in it and this slot has goblins and this slot has ghosts and this slot has zombies. They're just kind of like the minis that I might need at any moment to create a random encounter that are very common. And then I have more specific minis that I swap in and out of that box depending on the session that I'm running. The reason I bring this up is because Steamforge Games did a kobold box, which if you're it's got an adventure in the box and you can run that adventure. And I think it partners with like another box they did with a big dragon in it, which is super cool. But it's just like, you get one of those boxes, you've got all the kobolds you need, you know, to run multiple adventures. You don't just have to run what's in that box. You've got all the minions you need and a couple special kobolds to run an entire kobold filled dungeon. And then you get a goblin, one of those, and then you get a, you know, whatever, if you're a miniature fanatic like I am. And it's just nice having those kind of workhorse minis that you know you're going to get repeated use out of, whether you're running for the same group or not. And that's kind of what I would hope come, whether it's kobolds, goblins, bandits, gnolls. It might not be gnolls because that's a very Forgotten Realmsy thing. But, you know, whatever it happens to be.
No, gnolls are totally SRD. You ever play World of Warcraft? Gnolls all over the place in the human starting area there.
No. Hell yeah.
Yeah.
Love
gnolls. I love gnolls.
Hopefully it's gnolls. Gnolls are great.
Then. Yeah. Fingers crossed for gnolls.
Fingers crossed for gnolls.
Vote for gnolls 2024. Yeah,
first. Just everybody, just start hitting Steamforge Games and Kobold Press with hashtag gnolls for Tales of the Valiant.
Gnolls, they'll eat your face.
But yeah, no, it sounds cool. It's a cool partnership. So I can't wait to see what they produce. Speaking of cool partnerships, every so often, in fact, every week, the Eldritch Lorecast partners with its listeners to create topics, because you ask us questions and we answer them. And Dale Kingsmill, where would people want to send those emails if they were going to be answered by the Eldritch Lorecast?
Why Benjamin Byrne, they would send those emails to podcast at ghostfangaming.com. Nobody is allowed to question my decisions, all right?
No, that's fine. That's okay. Your decisions are your own.
My art is my own.
This first question coming in from Ricardo, who's kind of a little bit of a follow-up on the conversation we had last week on adventure modules, asking whether adventure modules inherently or pre-written adventures inherently railroad the party. Ricardo can't imagine really running one of these and staying on course with the adventure as written without putting in weird guardrails that would make the party feel like they're being blocked from going off course. I did like Ricardo's quote, which I'm not going to agree with, but asking, are pre-written adventures antithetical to the basic premise of a role-playing game?
It's a good, like, essay question.
It is a good essay question. It's also very strong wording for an opinion on pre-written adventures. And then kind of asking more broadly than that, if you do run pre-written adventures, how do you keep your players on track within the bounds of the adventure? If you're trying to get to the end of that adventure.
I'm going to bring up something that I think we talked about in one of the very first episodes of the Lorecast, way back when.
In the early days,
before the sun was on fire, we had a conversation where we talked about something that I do see in a lot of these pre-written adventures, which I think is a key element of them not being total railroads, is design that follows a structure of pools and streams. So there are sections of it where, yes, you are on a more or less direct path, and then there are areas where it's kind of more up to you. You can decide who you go and talk to in the town. You can decide what threads you're going to follow and pull on. I feel like back in the day, James was the one to talk more about that, so I'll leave James to talk more about that as a person who has written these kinds of adventures. But the other thing worth saying is that the thing with a pre-written adventure versus railroading to me has to legitimately stop you from making any other decisions. It's not just, oh, there's kind of a pre-planned shape to the story and what direction you go in. It has to be like, no, you can't do that. You have to do this other thing that I had prepared for. And I just don't think that that is the same thing as what's happening. But now I'm going to let the designers talk in more detail.
When I brought up pools and streams in that early episode, it was the early Witcher games that made me think of it, because they're, you know, they're action RPGs, but they're broken down into these chapters that have these sort of mini open worlds expressed within them. And you might even return to the same area chapter over chapter, and you'll see how major events, boss battles, you know, completing certain quests will radically alter the state of the game world. And I would say generally, I still agree pretty strongly with that as a core component of good adventure design. It can be difficult, but it's less difficult in TTRPGs than in video games sometimes, because you can just say everything is the same except for this. And if there are different, let me say that differently. Things have changed in this broad way, and then leave it to the DM to come and come up with the details, as opposed to making a whole new map with new assets, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. From an adventure designer's standpoint, I would say the main thing you need to give to the DM and the players, they have to agree on, is a big picture overall objective, right? The overall objective for Tomb of Annihilation, since it's on the mind, is stop the death curse. And you discover how you do that over the course of the adventure. If your players aren't interested in stopping the death curse, they're not interested in playing this adventure. And no amount of pools and streams can help you if they don't want to be there. In which case, you know, that's kind of a broader issue, because you did pay $50 for that hardcover. And if your players aren't interested in playing, then I can't game design you out of that problem. But if they agree on the premise, then Sean has something to say.
All this is wonderful. And here's the way I look at it. Adventures can't railroad, but game masters can. Adventures can be linear. And sometimes adventures have to be linear, because the whole point of the adventure is to help tell a story. And if you want the game masters to get the most out of the thing you're creating, it helps to know what level the characters are when they reach a certain point, because then you can make the encounters fit that. What railroading means, as someone I already said, I think Dale said, is taking away the agency of the player. There was an example online that was perfect. This player said, we were supposed to save people in this building, and I cast Fireball without remembering that it actually burns everything around it. And so the player casts Fireball, and it should have crisped all the people that were in the building and collapsed the building on them. And the DM just ignored it. And people at the table were pointing out, you know, this would have happened. And the DM's like, well, we'll just forget about that. We're not going to have the consequence of your actions mean anything. That's what railroading is. Or railroading is saying to the player, yes, I know you want to go see the sheriff, but I'm not going to let you go see the sheriff. I'm going to shut that right down, and you must do something else. So what adventures can't do that. Adventures can't pull a gun out on the game master and say, you may not do anything except what is written. That's the game master's prerogative. So there are good linear adventures that understand if people are accepting the goal, there is this path that they will likely take. And it sets up that path for the game master to help tell the story through. The game master is certainly free to do other things. And if the adventure is well written, and if there's enough space, the adventure can say, here are some other things that this might do. And if the adventure is really well written, what it says is, this adventure is meant to be used in this way, but here are several other ways that you can use it if your party or if you wish to use it another way. by telling clearly what the objective of the NPCs are, by telling clearly what the theme of the entire adventure is supposed to be and ways to carry out that theme regardless of where the players end up, right? All of those things are tools, but in the end, stories are generally linear. Unless you're writing interactive fiction, movies tend to go start at the beginning and go to the end. So the experiences that a lot of people expect when they play a game is that linear experience within reason.
I also just don't like the term railroading. I think it's used as a cudgel against GMs, and it's kind of like new GMs are taught to fear this term. Like, are you railroading your, you know, and it's a real YouTube-y thing of like, you know, reasons you suck as a GM and railroading's like, you know, ways to stop railroad. You know, I'm not saying that these videos necessarily exist, but I'm kind of generalizing a bit. But
they do.
Well, I've just grown to hate the term because the adventures that I tend to run tend to be, and this is probably true for most people in all honesty, but they tend to be like unwritten modules, which is that I know where I want the story to go and I know what I want the party to accomplish. And I think that it's good, the skill you need to develop as a GM, which Dale has mentioned a few times, is to incentivize the players to follow the story threads, to tempt them rather than force them somewhere. And it is a skill, I think, as a GM, you do need to develop a little bit, but not being afraid of using tools like the Quantum Ogre to keep your players on track and yet help them feel like they have a sense of agency within the adventure, you know, which it might be something like, you know, do you want to travel north to tackle the ice castle or do you want to travel south into the swamp caves? And you have this NPC that you need the players to meet for your story. Well, they can choose whether they want the ice castle or the swamp cave. Those are two different locations to go and explore, but this NPC could exist in either of those locations. And so you can keep them kind of finding the things you need them to find and interact with, and they can choose how they interact with them necessarily. But I don't think you need to, as a GM, be afraid of those things as long as you can keep the players feeling like they're making the choices and they're incentivized, as opposed to ever needing to say to them, no, you need to go here. You can't do that.
Yeah.
You know, I don't go to the swamp caves. You can't go there yet.
You get there and actually the road is blocked off and there's nothing that you can do to clear the road and you have to go north instead.
There's a big ice castle in the swamp.
But sometimes like you can do that as well, right? Yeah. Like sometimes as long as you make it clear to the party that they're not suddenly running into an invisible wall, but you flag, you say something like the swamp has been locked off by the king's men who are guarding it. You can go down there and you can try to grapple with them. It is a choice that you can make, but it is probably not going to end well for you because they're so, you know, as long as it makes sense with the motivations of the characters in the story, you can kind of lock off areas, I think, and make them less accessible than earlier. Sorry,
the thing for me, I think we need to expand this metaphor, right? Because we've been using just the term railroading to mean a series of different things for a long time now. But the point of railroading ultimately is like, you are on a train. You have no control over where the train is going. The driver barely has control over where the train is going. It's just on these tracks and it can only go there. And you can look over and go, oh, what a beautiful lake. I'd like to go and stop at that lake. But you can't go to the lake. And then if you're in a sandbox, it's more like, you know, you're on a beautiful walk or you're driving, you know, you're cross country on a bike or something, right? Like you can go wherever the hell you want. And maybe pre-written adventure is something in between. It's a highway. You can go off in different directions. You can get onto a different, you know, a different highway. You can go, but for the most part, there are, you know, limited exits. So if you want to go and visit the pretty lake, you can do it. But you got to get off here. That sort of a thing maybe is a better extension of the metaphor if we're talking about pre-written adventures.
I agree. I refer to it as the open road. You know, you're kind of moving in a forward direction and you can kind of, you know, move left and right within that direction.
You're still relying on where the infrastructure is.
I want to talk about the real enemy here.
Who's the real enemy, James?
Okay, I'm sorry.
Is it the Pope?
Legos.
Is it the Pope?
No.
The thumbnail for this episode is you won't believe what the Pope did.
It's slog. It's pace crashing. And there are pros and cons to whatever approach you decide to take, whether it's the open road or the railroad or the sandbox or whatever, you know, cute little metaphor we want to come up with to describe levels of freedom versus sort of narrative impetus. And the thing about a really good railroad is that it's moving at 300 miles an hour down the track. It is barreling with so many tons of steam and steel and narrative purpose. Whereas if you're roaming a sandbox, generally you're taking it at a fairly leisurely, hex crawly pace. And I have had campaigns where I changed the style of like agency granting I gave to my players, depending on what my instinct about the story told me to do. And there were times when I was wrong and it created friction with me and my players. There were times when I was right and everyone was all of a sudden in a flow state, right? I was playing Princes of the Apocalypse, which is the first major published campaign I ever ran. And that campaign is very sandboxy. It's a vast hex crawly map with several points of interest and a big dungeon, mega dungeon beneath it. And all of those, both the hex crawl and the mega dungeon, very sandboxy, very slow styles of gameplay. And so using NPCs and set piece encounters, and honestly, even set piece like 8-session-long narrative arcs, I felt very in control of what the narrative momentum of that game was doing at any given time. And that's not to say sandboxes can't be fast and railroads can't become interminable slow slogs, because especially if the players are fighting against you, or, you know, that sounds very pejorative, especially if you and the players aren't on the same wavelength. Railroads can become very bad and sloggy very quickly. But if you're on the same wavelength, if you're thinking about what your players want, if you're thinking about what would be narratively compelling at all times, being able to switch between vast free roaming and incredibly intense action set piece, narrative set piece focused gameplay, you can have a really dynamic and fun and thrilling play experience by doing that.
It probably does also depend on your game group, right? Like perhaps they're not chaotic players. They just like to, you know, interview Boblin the Goblin instead of Skull Lord McGuffin.
McMcGuffin.
But other groups, you know, I found with my play group, sometimes when I try to give them sandboxy areas, they can get a bit lost and they become aimless, because they want me to incentivize them and to give them a goal to move towards. Mm-hmm. It was actually something that I was taught as an educator was, you know, when you tell kids in a room that your choices are boundless, and we've talked about this more recently with D&D combat and stuff as well, like teaching people the game. When you say your choices are boundless, it can often paralyze people into not making a choice because they can't, you know, there's no information going into their minds about what would be the better or worse choice or why they would make one choice or the other. And so my adventure design philosophy has tended to be always make sure there's a second option, but you don't need to make sure there's infinite options. You know, give them, they can do A or B, maybe they can do C, or they can do A or B and they can discover C if they decide to investigate a little bit. So that there's, you know, kind of lanes that they can go down that make it feel open and like they're making choices, but they're still incentivized and limited in the choices that they can make,
fair,
so that they can make a decision.
A lot of people hate that. They hate that illusion of choice. I don't mind it. I think a lot of people don't mind it, but there are some people for whom that's just like, that's as bad as no choice. And I get that. I understand that mindset. But even, I guess it comes down to how much prep you're willing to do as a DM as well. Like if your players do make a choice and you listen to that choice, you go, okay, well, what's the fallout from that? If I know this pre-written adventure, if I understand what the story is and where it's going, how can I fit this choice they've made into that material? And it can lead you fairly far away from the heart of the adventure, but I think if you are, you know, willing to put in that work, you can often make it kind of puzzle in. It's Lego. It's Lego, not a puzzle. So you can build what you need to build with the set. Mm-hmm.
Well, this is why I used the example before of going to the ice castle or the swamp, is because the legitimate choice is the ice castle or the swamp, Do you want to explore an ice castle or swamp? Though that's a real choice. But you will run into this NPC depending on which one you go to, because the GM needs you to run into this NPC. So it's sort of, I understand the thought process behind, you know, false choices and not choices. But I think the trick and the skill of hiding the rails, so to speak, on either side of the open road is mixing in those false choices or those quantum ogres with the legitimate choices, so the players can see where their choices are mattering and feel like where they don't, that it was because of their choices anyway. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
They feel like they met that NPC because they chose to travel to the ice castle, because that's different from traveling to the swamp, and they don't know that that NPC wasn't inherently in the ice castle.
And sometimes you just have to ask the players, not the characters, the players, what do you want?
Mm.
Right. If I put in front of you a, you know, someone runs out of the woods and they're covered in blood and they're yelling for help, and you just leave them and continue down the road. Okay, that's a choice. But now I need to know, what do you want? What do you want this game to be? Because obviously helping people is not a thing. A big bag of gold is at the end of this. Do you go there? The person yells, I'm very rich, I can reward you. And they still go on down the road. Okay, what do you want? I know who your mother was. The person yells to the one NPC who says that they grew up in an orphanage. Yeah. Now do you go? No? What do you want? What do you want out of this game? Let me give it to you. But you need to throw me a line here so I can make this campaign and the choices that you say you want to make viable in the story that you want to tell with this character.
Contrary to popular belief, I cannot read minds.
And to bring it back around, that is the biggest challenge with published adventure modules, is it gives you goals, but it does not track player motivations. And so your players and you as a GM need to find some way to tie those motivations into what the adventure wants them to do. The adventure has a motivation. It wants something. It wants you to kill that dragon or something. It wants you to stop that death curse. And you know, I guess a death curse is a fairly strong motivation. We're all going to die otherwise. But you know, it's an applicable one, but it's a weak one, right? It's not a very compelling one.
Yeah.
If Sarac is actually your grandpa, now there's an interesting motivation.
You are a Palpatine.
Very Rise of Skywalker. Yeah,
somehow
Palpatine's your father. Returned.
Yes.
And not to pick on Tomb of Annihilation since we're talking about it, but that was one where there was a flaw in the adventure. That flaw is there's a death curse. People are literally rotting away and dying. Oh, but look, there's dinosaur races.
Right.
And so the adventure wants you to explore. The adventure wants you to do these fun, novel things when the actual adventure wants you to find out why the death curse is happening as quickly as you can before Granny keels over here.
Yeah, that's a real problem that video game RPGs have a lot as well, where I end up just mainlining the story because it feels like I should, you know, like I'm not going to go play
darts
with my friend.
You made the stakes really high. I'm not going to waste time.
Yeah. Well, we have gone over time here. To thank us for that, give this podcast a like if you're listening to it on YouTube, or give it 5 stars on any other listening platform, or likes, or feed the machine, iron within, iron without, falling into 40K territory now. I think that's the quote. Anyway, my name's been Ben Byrne. It was James Hake, Dale Kingsmill, Sean Merwin. If you want to catch us live, we will be back again 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 4 p.m. Pacific on a Monday in the United States, or Tuesday, 10 a.m. Australian Eastern Standard Time.
At least until daylight savings ends.
I've been Ben Byrne here with Dale Kingsmill, Sean Merwin, James Hake. Farewell.
Bye.
Ah.
That's my bid for a new outro. Anyone? How do you feel? Right, how do you feel?
Ooh, the double finger hearts.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
we're talking.
Bam, 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 bam.
Ah, just feeling the love.
Yeah.